Welcome to Murder Most Foul, a podcast devoted to exploring famous murder cases of our time. Some solved, some unsolved, but all fascinating and guaranteed to raise the hairs on the back of your neck. I'm your host, Jim Solanowski. Today's episode, Looking for Madeline. As a father, I cannot think of anything more horrifying than discovering that your four-year-old daughter has been abducted from her bed in the middle of the night while your family is vacationing in a foreign country. But that is exactly what happened to the parents of Madeline McCann. The cold case, which is over 15 years old, is as controversial as it is disturbing. What better person to take us through it than author Robin Swan, who, with her husband Anthony Summers, has written more than one controversial book? Welcome, Robin.
Hi, Jim. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So before we dive in, why don't you give us a little, give my listeners a little background, and certainly how you came to meet your husband and co-author Anthony Summers. And I understand he's in the other room right now waiting for us to finish so you can make dinner. So I'll try not to keep you too long. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
In spite of the fact that I now live in Ireland, I was born and raised in Connecticut, went to Smith College, then went to graduate school in Washington back in the days when there was still a Soviet Union because I wanted to be a Sovietologist. Luckily, I wised up quickly and got out of that right before the Soviet Union crumbled. I went to work as a young journalist in Washington, starting to do freelance work and book research, and worked on a book with the wonderful John le Carré, worked on a book called The Night Manager as his researcher, and then moved into other kinds of book research, as well as continuing to freelance, and met an Irish-British journalist named Anthony Summers, who was a friend of my bureau chief. And I got a phone call one day from my bureau chief and who said, look, a friend of mine is coming through town. He needs a researcher. I offered the job to Mark, but Mark's busy doing something else. Mark being a very senior colleague of mine at Bloomberg, but who was then my opposite number as junior dog's body in the office. And I said, okay, yeah, I'm second best as usual. And I said, well, who is the guy? And he said, well, his name is Anthony Summers. And I said, well, what has he done? And he said, well, he wrote a book of a big biography of Marilyn Monroe. And I said, yeah, move on. He said, well, he wrote a book about the Kennedy assassination. And I said, yeah, move on. He said, he wrote a book about the Profumo affair in the UK. I said, yeah, move on. He said, well, he wrote a book about the disappearance of the Russian imperial family. And I said, oh, what was that book called? And he said, the book was called A File on the Tsar. And I reached up onto my bookshelf and I took down a first edition of The File on the Tsar, which had inspired me to learn Russian and to go to college and study Russian and become a Sovietologist. It was the book that changed my life. And there on the inside fly cover was a picture of a long-haired Anthony Summers, circa 1976. And I thought, all right, he looks okay. He wrote at least one good book. I don't know about the others. And I agreed to meet him. And we met in a restaurant in Washington, D.C., and he walked in with a foot-high pile of interviews to be done, which he claimed was only about 2 weeks' worth of work. And he gave me the work and went off back to Ireland. And 2 years later, when he could no longer afford to pay me, he married me. And that is how I came to live in Ireland, and we have worked together ever since.
So So, Robin, before we jump into talking about Looking for Madeline, I would be remiss if I didn't take a few moments here to talk about your other books. And I'd love you to tell us about the book you wrote with Anthony on the 9/11 tragedy that did position you for a possible Pulitzer Prize in history. So tell us about your 9/11 book.
We wrote our book about 9/11 between 2007 and 2011. It was done to mark the 10th anniversary of the attacks. We're very proud of it. It was indeed finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for History that year. The thing about that book is that we quite arrogantly take on subjects that lots of other people have covered and try to do them better. And sometimes we succeed. I like to think we succeed more than we don't succeed. We are very, very dogged, and we work every day, 7 days a week. We look under stones, and we look under stones again. And on that book, although in the end, you and I discussed this earlier in our pre-interview, the book, for some members of the 9/11 truth community, we're disappointed that two people like Anthony and myself, who've covered conspiracies in various forms over the years and are not per se anti-conspiracy theory, there are those who are disappointed that we did not, in the end, find any evidence to support the notion that the United States government had any hand in perpetrating those attacks. Now, that does not mean that the 9/11 Commission and the previous joint inquiry succeeded in turning over all the evidence there was. They did not. And even members of those inquiries would say to this day that they did not. The director of the 9/11 Commission staff and one of the former members has spoken of the commission's work as a first draft of history. And it is only a first draft of history. You can't do anything completely working under the time and financial constraints that the commission was working under and the political constraints. And our book, written now more than a dozen years ago, made an attempt to really get to some of those. And one of the things that we looked at then and that we're still looking at and that I'm doing work on today and I work on whenever I can is the potential involvement of members of the Saudi government and the Saudi royal family in supporting Al-Qaeda and their links to the hijackers themselves. And there is an ongoing piece of very important civil litigation in the United States in which some 6,000 members of 9/11 families and victims are suing the Saudi government and named other parties, including some Saudi charities, for their roles in aiding and abetting terrorists. And we are finding out more and more every day, thanks to discovery on that case, and thanks to never-ending Freedom of Information Act requests and mandatory declassification review requests done by people like myself. Only last week, I finally, after a 15-year attempt to do so, got the 9/11 Commission interview of Prince Turki bin Faisal, the former head of Saudi intelligence, that no one had ever seen before. And the glaring thing about that interview is what they failed to ask him. And that is why we are still on this trail, and that is why we are still in need of answers about 9/11 and the Saudi role. Sure. Well, Anthony on his own wrote a book in the 1970s after the House Select Committee on Assassinations reported their finding that there had been a quote-unquote probable conspiracy in the murders of President Kennedy and of Martin Luther King. Now, probable conspiracy, that's a government organization coming to that conclusion. On the strength of that, Anthony went out and re-explored some of the things, the key things that they had looked at, and wrote a book called Conspiracy, later edited many, many times subsequently in many new editions, now is sold under the title of Not in Your Lifetime, which was a quote from the Warren Commissioner, Earl Warren, who said that there would be some things relating to national security that might not be revealed to the American people in their lifetimes. We are now approaching the deadline for when that could possibly be, of people who were alive and adults back in 1960, and there are still things being withheld from us about the Kennedy assassination. Now, let me go back and do some Robin trying to dig herself out of a hole here. Our government, our legal system, recognizes the existence of the crime of conspiracy. We have a thing called the RICO statutes, which support the notion that people gather together in order to perpetrate a crime, and that is a conspiracy. So if you call someone a conspiracy theorist using that definition, I am a conspiracy theorist. I believe they exist. The 19 hijackers who hijacked those planes on 9/11 did so as a result of a conspiracy. That is not the same as claiming that the quote-unquote deep state is behind everything. The deep state is in many instances peopled by human beings doing a day job, just like you and I do, working hard, trying to do what they think is best. And to live in a fictional world where everyone working for our government is tarred with the same brush, and they are all part of a vast conspiracy, does history a great injustice. At the same time, we do have to look at what we're being told and examine it carefully and try to apply some discipline to what the facts are, to what the evidence we see before us. And we have, each of us as citizens, has the obligation to do that. And that is what we try to do with every single one of our books. So basically, if everybody's mad at me, I must be doing something right. Because on some of our books, it's the left that hates me. On some, it's the right. On some, it's the McCann haters. On another book, it could be, you know, the family of Frank Sinatra. But everybody hates Robin. And that's okay, because that means I'm doing my job. So in the case of the Kennedy assassination, my husband's book was very well received at the time because it was considered a serious book, looking hard at some of the remaining fundamental questions that had not been answered. And those are questions, and serious questions, about the role of the intelligence agencies. Had they had any prior involvement with Lee Harvey Oswald before the assassination? And did that kind of possible prior involvement mean that Lee Harvey Oswald had been influenced to kill the president? Did it mean he had not been there at all? Did it mean that maybe he had killed the president, but any operations that they were involved with that involved Lee Harvey Oswald led them to do the worst possible thing and cover it up? All of those questions still exist today. And there are really good people working this story. And I would count among them people who take completely opposite views from my own. Gerald Posner, investigative reporter, did a very good book called Case Closed. Doesn't believe that Lee Harvey Oswald was anything but a lone assassin. On the other hand, David Talbot, the former editor of Salon, Jefferson Morley, former Washington Post reporter, now who runs a JFK-related website, has done lots of work on the field of intelligence and the intelligence agencies in the Kennedy assassination. An exceptional researcher. These are really good, serious-minded people. And the dean of conspiracy thinking, the dean of all this, Peter Dale Scott, professor, former English professor, University of California at Berkeley, I believe, a man now in his 90s, who continues to ask tough questions about all of these subjects, from the Kennedy assassination to 9/11 to Pearl Harbor. But they try to do that, I hope, and I know those men in particular, try to ask their questions with an open mind to the possibility that they might be wrong, that there's still evidence out there we have not seen. And I suppose my final note on this, back in the early 1990s, after Oliver Stone's absolutely execrable film about the Kennedy assassination came out, there was a commission that was formed to look at Kennedy presidential assassination records, the Records Review Board. And under the process that review board unleashed, President Clinton declared that all records potentially related to the Kennedy assassination needed to be released within a particular time period. That time period has now come and gone. And no president has authorized the complete release of all of the documents. They've been parceled out slowly over the years. But last week, President Biden took the decision that some 4,000 documents, either in whole or in part, were still too sensitive to be revealed to the American people. And every single one of the authors that I have just mentioned, from the Gerald Posner, who says there was no conspiracy and he did it alone, to the Peter Dale Scott, to the Jefferson Morley, and to Anthony Summers and Robin Swan, says, free the documents. If there are names or agents who need to be redacted, let them be redacted. If not, let us see those documents. Let's put an end to all these years and years of theorizing and let the American people know what our government was doing. We have some pretty good ideas of the things that went on in those days, but let us know the full extent.
Now, your books and articles that you write, both you and Anthony, have stirred up controversy, we can say. And one of those, again, was Anthony's coverage of JFK, his book. And then you were, I guess, tapped to be part of a documentary for Frontline / PBS, which kind of went awry. So why don't you tell my listeners a little about that?
Anthony and I had agreed to act as consultants for Frontline consultants and reporters on a Frontline documentary for the 30th anniversary of the assassination. And over the course of the almost 2 years of the production of that project, we covered certain aspects of the story, in particular, the comings and goings of Lee Harvey Oswald in Mexico City, an episode about which there's much controversy. And I'm not going to go into it here. It's far too complicated. And there's been much found out since we did our research 30 years ago. People should read Jefferson Morley's books on the subject and John Newman's books on the subject. That said, when we got time very close to the editing process, much of what we had learned about Mexico City was on the cutting room floor. And we felt that that decision, those editorial decisions, unduly influenced the shape of the film, and we didn't believe it left an honest impression of what we had discovered. It very much gave the impression that the Frontline team had uncovered evidence that Oswald had acted alone, and we didn't feel that that was an accurate reflection of the totality of the work done. And so after much what I would call argy-bargy, we decided we would take our names off it. So we took our names off the film, and you know, it luckily, you know, back in those days, you could have an editorial difference of opinion with people who were colleagues and live to fight another day. And we went on both of us to work on other subjects with those same colleagues and made, we hope, some good films and good products, but not that particular one. Don't stand by that one. I think, as I said, with my usual level of deep humility, that Tony and I try to do books that no one has done before, that many people have done before, and do them better. And, you know, people can judge whether that we succeed in that or not. But because of that, we sort of have there's a picture that publishers have built up of us in their eyes of people for a big subject. Now, you wouldn't think that a three-year-old toddler is a big subject, but Madeleine McCann in these islands where we live in Europe and in the UK is JonBenet Ramsey to the United States audience. Madeleine's face and picture have figured in the newspapers here almost every day since she disappeared in 2007. And the controversy around the case has been extraordinary. And it goes on and on and on. And when we came to the story in 2011, right after our 9/11 book, We too wondered what is it in it for us to tell? What is the story for Tony and Robin here? You know, but there are important stories beyond the true crime story here. There's the story about the power of the internet. There is the story about the awful world of child sexual abuse, child rape. There is the story of international policing and the failures of that. There are stories about conspiracy theories and the dangers of those. So there were things in the Madeleine story that appealed to us. And like it or not, we have a little girl who is about 5 years older than Madeleine, whose name is Madeleine, whose middle name is Madeleine. And one night when we were watching the news with her, it was an anniversary of Madeleine's disappearance. And there was an interview with Kate and Jerry McCann, Madeleine's parents. And they were asked, you know, how long will you keep on looking for your daughter? And they said, well, we'll look forever. And our daughter turned to me and said, Mommy, how long is forever? And then she said, and would you look for me forever? And those are, you know, gut-wrenching questions as a parent to ask yourself. But it did force me to think about what her parents felt and what they meant in that moment when they said they would look for their child forever.
As you point out in the book, many assumptions were made in the beginning of the investigation or the search for the chief among that, well, she probably just wandered off. We'll find her somewhere in the resort. But that didn't happen, did it?
One doesn't want to make any assumptions. If you're starting an investigation, a mistake that was made in this investigation early on was to assume what was happening and what we were looking at when a three-year-old child disappears without a trace. And that's a mistake in the policing that we'll get to in a moment. But in terms of what actually happened, there was an event in which two young doctors, Jerry and Kate McCann, two young GPs, he was a cardiac specialist, took their three tiny children on a family holiday to the Algarve, to a small resort village called Praia da Luz, on the Portuguese Algarve. They were accompanied by seven of their friends, other couples and their own small children. All the children were sort of aged three or four or under, quite a little gaggle, a little party to go out there. And they all went and stayed at a resort, which they thought was a safe place, for a week in early May 2007. Every night, the parents left the children asleep in their apartment, in their separate apartments, and went to dinner in a small restaurant in the hotel that was across the pool from where they were staying. It's about 120 yards as the crow flies across the pool. They could see the balconies of their apartments. The children were asleep, and every half an hour, every 20 minutes, every 40 minutes, they went and checked their respective children. They listened outside the door, stuck their heads in, made sure nobody was crying, etc. This all went very well for the first four nights of the holiday, and on the Thursday night of May the 3rd, going into the 4th, after a series of checks had been done, Kate McCann returned to her apartment and discovered that her oldest child, three-year-old Madeleine, who was about to turn four the next week, was missing from her bed and has never been seen since. And that is the story that captured the absolute imaginations of the public in the United Kingdom and across Europe. Beautiful blonde toddler, very beautiful, very attractive parents, well-educated backgrounds. And it just took off. There was a very frantic search, and the McCann parents and their friends began by searching themselves first. They tried repeatedly to get to report the matter to the police. They immediately got in touch with the hotel staff, and really there was a wholehearted and concerted effort by the family and the friends and the hotel staff to find the child without success. And when the local police arrived, and here's where the mistakes start to creep in, and mistakes having a long-term effect. It's a small town, underfunded police force, local beat cops arrive. They assume they're looking for a child that maybe has wandered off in the middle of the night looking for mommy and daddy. You know, why aren't you here? They don't immediately assume she's been taken. This is a very safe place, they think. This is not the thing, kind of thing that happens here. They're shocked. And so they don't treat the scene as a crime scene. You know, many people trample through the apartment, making it very difficult later on to look for fingerprints. There are rescue dogs brought in. The dogs shed hairs everywhere. The many, many people trying to help search the apartment, leaving their own fingerprints everywhere. It's a mess. It's a mess of a scene. The British police, in trying to help, make things worse by being very undiplomatic in their dealings with their Portuguese colleagues, by essentially treating the Portuguese as sort of, you know, uneducated, illiterate imbeciles, a thing which the British are very good at doing when they want to. As a person living in Ireland, I know that. But the whole scene became rather desperate, and there were so many mistakes made that one doesn't really have time to address all of them here. But what happened in the end was that after several months of frustrated looking and not succeeding, the Portuguese police went back to doing what they should have done at the beginning and considering the possibility of the parents as suspects in their daughter's disappearance. Now, usually in such a case, you eliminate those closest to the victim at the beginning. That way you can work with them as other victims and not later as suspects. By the time the Portuguese got around to considering the McCanns as suspects, they had been sold on the idea that the British police had some highly trained police dogs, a cadaver dog and a blood-sniffing dog, that could find Madeline no matter where she might be. And these dogs were brought onto the case in August of 2007. So months after Madeline disappeared. And they proceeded to give off alerts in the McCann's apartment and to some belongings of the McCann's, and even to a rental car that the McCann's had rented weeks after Madeline disappeared. And that so badly muddied the waters, along with repeated leaks from the case, that the original sympathy for the McCanns was turned on its head, and they became the world's greatest villains, and were just, between the press and the internet, they were harried unmercifully, and they were made official suspects in the case by the Portuguese police, a status which wasn't lifted for almost a year, and when no evidence of any involvement by the parents was ever discovered, they were finally eliminated as suspects. The McCanns were encouraged to really take part in the investigation themselves. The McCanns were told early on by ICMEC, which is the International Center for Missing and Exploited Children in the United States, which is considered the world's leading organization on finding missing children, that the best thing they could do to get Madeline back was to keep her face in front of the public. So from the very beginning, they used their family, they used every connection they possibly could to get pictures of Madeline out, to get press coverage. And all during that summer, that first summer, They went everywhere. They went to the Vatican. They did radio. They did TV. They were everywhere, telling Madeline's story, showing her picture, looking for help. When they were made our Guidos at the end of the summer, they decided it was time to go home and resume the search from there, because their feeling was that as long as they were the chief suspects, no one was really looking for Madeline. And that is a view that they maintained until 2011. Because what happened was that McCanns left Portugal at the end of the summer of 2007, returned to the UK. And for the next year, the guts of a year, the Portuguese police effort was largely focused on building a case against the McCanns, a case which never materialized. When the case was subsequently shelved, the middle of 2008, a year after Madeline went missing, because of lack of evidence, the situation was that no one was actively looking for their child. So they hired a series of private investigators and continued the hunt. I'd just like to speak briefly about the forensic evidence for a moment, because one of the things that gets said about the McCann case, always, every time I'm asked about this case, people in their blissful ignorance assume the parents did it, didn't they? Or I always suspected those parents. As you said, how could they possibly have left their children in the apartment while they had dinner? We can all argue till the day we die about whether or not the McCanns made a bad or good decision in trusting that their system of checking on the children was a good one or a bad one. I don't think even the McCanns would today claim it was a good decision, but that doesn't make them guilty of a crime. We all make mistakes, and that is a mistake that they are going to live with forever. That said, there is no forensic evidence in this case. The dog alerts, the Portuguese police misconstrued the relevance of dog alerts. Even the dog's handler told the police that a dog signal would only ever be used in a court of law or any other way in a police investigation if it were subsequently corroborated by the discovery of physical evidence. No physical evidence ever emerged to show that Madeline was either hurt, bled, or died in the McCann's apartment. Okay, no evidence of that was found. The DNA that was picked up was poorly treated, badly analyzed, and the interpretation of the results was inaccurately reported. If you read our book, you will see that the British Forensic Service that did the analysis said that in many cases, there were so many numerous people who could possibly have contributed to DNA samples that they were completely invalid. Moreover, there was no good fingerprint evidence. There was just no good evidence. There's nothing. The senior forensic scientist for the Irish Forensic Service told me, having read all of the reports, looked at all of the blood information a lot more closely and with greater care and expertise than many of the internet sleuths that expound on it on a daily basis, she told me that what we had was a whole lot of nothing. And that is what we had in this case, a whole lot of nothing. And so after the Portuguese shelved the case, the McCanns tried their best to continue looking for Madeline with private detectives. They too came up short. Finally, in 2011, the British police, having been kind of egged on into it and manipulated by the McCanns into doing it, by the level of press attention brought, conducted a review of the case. And it was called a scoping report. And it was undertaken by a brilliant former head of the British Child Exploitation Online Protection Service, a veteran counterintelligence officer, a man with vast experience in the area of child sex abuse and sexual exploitation. And he reviewed all that had been done by both the British and Portuguese police forces and concluded that there were important areas that had been badly bungled and that there was room, and indeed that it would be highly desirable to go back and try to address some of those mistakes. And that led to the formation of a thing called Operation Grange, which was a British police review of the case, which began in 2011 with a small group of officers and grew into a reinvestigation of the case, which now includes a reinvestigation by the Portuguese police and by German police officials also working on the case.
So fast forward to 2023, and in fact, just recently, before I reached out to you, there has been some movement in the case, and the authorities are looking at a suspect. Now, it's not a new suspect. It was someone who was suspected at the time. So tell us where we are today.
So where we are now is a direct result of that review. And among the things that that review pointed to was the fact that the pedophiles who had frequented in the Algarve and the British police had handed over dossiers on something like 50-odd pedophiles known to frequent the Algarve. The police officer involved, Jim Gamble, who headed the review, didn't believe they'd ever been adequately probed. And the other thing that he found very wanting, that he did not believe that there had ever been an adequate analysis of all the phone traffic data that had been gathered by the Portuguese police. And those things in particular, he felt were ripe for further exploitation by later police forces. And that's what they've been doing. They've been good at. And that has led us to where we are now.
And where we are now is looking at a pedophile and rapist named Christian Bruckner.
Christian Bruckner is in jail in Germany, having been convicted of both some drug offenses, but also having been convicted of the violent rape of a 72-year-old American pensioner in the Algarve in Praia da Luz, very near the time with time period in which Madeline disappeared. Bruckner frequented in the Algarve for many, many years, knew the area very well. He has a history of child sexual abuse. He has been convicted on child sex charges, including convictions based on photographic evidence of him having molested a five-year-old girl in front of a camera. His history of child sex abuse goes back many, many years to when he himself was a teenager. Now, as in many parts of this case, questions still exist over whether or not Christian Bruckner is the man who took Madeleine McCann. A German prosecutor has said categorically both that Christian Bruckner is guilty and that he has concrete evidence, as he describes it, that he is guilty and that Madeleine is dead. He has further said that Madeleine died in the Algarve. We have not, however, in the 3 years since Christian Bruckner was named as a suspect, gotten any closer to the nature of the evidence that the Germans claim to have against him. The most significant piece of evidence known to us is that Christian Bruckner's phone was being used for about a half an hour in the vicinity of the Ocean Club within approximately 3,000 meters of the Ocean Club. That's 3 kilometers of the Ocean Club. On the night Madeleine disappeared, about an hour or two before her disappearance. So we have a known sexual predator within the vicinity of the club on the night Madeleine disappeared. That said, the other bits of testimony and witness statements against him are circumstantial. They are made by people who are themselves unsavory characters involved in petty crime and worse, some of them. And one must continue to keep a skeptical eye toward whether or not he is guilty. There have been mistakes made, even by the German police, in investigating Mr. Bruckner. They first were alerted to the possibility that he was involved in this abduction back in 2013. And what did they do? They sent him a letter telling him why they were interested in speaking to him, and sent it to his place of work. Needless to say, having been given such a great warning, they didn't get much out of Mr. Bruckner when they finally talked to him. Now, the policing mistakes are not just down to the Portuguese or the Germans. They include the Brits. The Brits began their investigation in 2011 saying they were going to go back to the beginning and look at everything anew. And yet they didn't find the phone call between Mr. Bruckner and someone on the night Madeline disappeared. He's one of the known pedophiles they were concerned about. But they didn't find it. That was found later by the Germans. So there are mistakes aplenty, and plenty of mistakes to go around. So yes, Christian Bruckner is a very, very good suspect. And as one colleague said to me, it almost has to be him, doesn't it? Well, having seen a number of pedophile suspects named in this case, some of whom were also living very close to Praia da Luz at that time, it's a frightening prospect that there were so many who could have fit the bill. And so, you know, I think that is where the case stands today. I'm currently involved in a film project with Anthony. We're working with colleagues on a film about Christian Bruckner. And I can't tell you much more than that, I'm afraid. Who it's for or when it will be out, it's anybody's guess, but hopefully there'll be more in that will be enlightening, and we're doing our best to get to people who are relevant to the story. But the serious point is, until we find who took Madeline, there is a criminal out there who poses a risk to other children. Christian Bruckner certainly posed a risk to other children. He posed a risk to adults as well. But if there are other men like him out there and not being found, not being caught in regard to the Madeline case or anything else, we need to continue to look.
Robin, I really want to thank you today for appearing on Murder Most Foul on this very, very sad and yet controversial case. So as we do wrap up, and I let you go have dinner with your husband, is there anything that you'd like to share with my audience?
Well, you know, Jim, thank you very much for having me. I think the only other important thing that I would like to add on this subject, the subject of Madeline McCann in particular, this was a very, very tough book to be involved with, a tough subject to deal with. The nature of the information one was dealing with every day was hard to stomach, because we're thinking about violence being perpetrated against children. The other thing, though, that was hard to stomach was the vilification that Anthony and I received at the end of writing this book. Before it was even published or available to be read by readers, people who hate the McCanns trolled the book on Amazon and basically buried it under one-star reviews, telling people not to buy it, that we were shills, that we were pedophiles, that, you know, every possible name you could, that we were only in it for a buck, every possible bit of abuse you could hurl at a couple of reporters was hurled at us. And frankly, we've spent our lives working on these kind of stories, trying to tell an honest story from the evidence that we find. We do it every day, 7 days a week to the detriment of our own family life. My own children have wondered at times if mommies and daddies ever get a day off. And we don't do that for the money. We do it because history matters and facts matter. You get to have your own opinion, but you don't get to have your own facts. And we keep digging. And I'm sorry if that offends some people's sensibilities, that they don't like the truths we find or the evidence we find. But that doesn't make our work illegitimate. It means maybe you need to go back and re-examine some of your opinions and your suppositions about the way the world works. And tragically, in the McCann case, Madeline's family have suffered for years because people have been too quick to judge and too unwilling to see them simply as human beings with flaws and failings, but human beings who are suffering and looking for their child. And I want to always remember that there are victims in this story, and those victims include Madeline's parents and her brother and sister, and they deserve our respect and our empathy, not vilification.
Well, Robin, I couldn't have said it better myself. So we're going to sign off now, and I'm going to, once again, just thank you so much from the bottom of my heart. So I'd like to thank you folks for kindly tuning in for another episode of Murder Most Foul. If you liked what you heard, I hope you'll tell your friends. Information about the podcast and an email link that can get a message to me can be found at the podcast's website, the address being www.murdermostfoul, all one word, no caps, no spaces, .com. So until we meet again, stay safe, and for God's sakes, don't murder anyone.